Well, I think we'll start. There are a number of other people who've said that they'll come at some point, but you never know how these things are going to go. So thank you very much for coming. And I just want to say a few words, well, about what we're going to do here, and then I'm going to say a few words. We're all going to say a few words about the book itself. Before that, I want to say why we don't have more copies of the book. There are a couple of reasons for that. One is that with such a small event, the publisher said that they could not send anyone to sell the book. But we do have a 50% discount on copies of the book, and you can take a flyer and they'll send you a copy of the book. We have copies you can look at here as well. The other reason, however, is that we were invited to participate in an open access publishing trial. There's a new project called Knowledge Unlatched that has signed on a number of publishers, including Cambridge, Oxford, Duke University, and Michigan, and so on, and Berghahn, obviously, to present them certain of their books each year that will become open access. And how they're financing this is a long story. They explain it on their website. If you're interested, you can look at that. But our book was selected for the second year of this trial. So the book is actually open access apart from one chapter. So although the entire book is available online, and I'll put up the website towards the end. This looks a little bit nicer here, so right now, so I'll leave it for the moment. But I'll give you the open access website address at the end.
Which chapter?
Azraz, the one in Bosnia. There's a problem with that. But of course, the book is also very nice looking, and some of us prefer to have books and rather than having PDFs, which I tend to lose amongst all of my files. So for those of you who would like a copy of the book, I would encourage you to take advantage of the 50% discount that we have. Now, I have introduced myself. I'm Rebecca Bryant. I'm the editor of the book. We have here today also Glenn Bowman, who is professor of socio-historical anthropology. That's right, yes?
That's right.
Socio-historical anthropology at University of Kent, and also one of the contributors to the book. David Hennig, who's a lecturer also at University of Kent in anthropology, who also happens to be the editor of the journal History and Anthropology. We're all just going to speak for about 10 minutes. We wanted this to be relatively informal, but we want you to be able to understand what the book is about. So we're each going to speak for maybe about 10 minutes and open the floor for a bit of discussion. And then we have, as you can see, wine waiting for us here. So I am just going to say a few words about the intellectual origins of the project. As some of you know, my own work is on Cyprus as well as in Turkey, and working especially on issues of conflict, displacement, and the everyday construction of borders. And during that research, I've consistently been puzzled by a phenomenon that people in the places where I work remark upon quite a lot, namely the way that people managed for centuries to live side by side in what seemed relatively peaceful conditions until suddenly they didn't. Right? And for some people, this meant that their neighbors no longer looked at them in the same way. For others, it meant that the places they lived suddenly changed. For example, borders were suddenly drawn where they didn't exist before. I think one of the most powerful illustrations of this is found in a BBC documentary made by the early 1990s made in the early 1990s by anthropologist Tony Bringa. And those of you who came to the conference that I organized a couple of months ago on post-Ottoman themes would have heard this illustration before. But I think that it illustrates the point very well. She made this film at the beginning of the 1990s, right as the Yugoslav War was beginning to really heat up, and she had already she had already been doing research in a village that was a mixed Muslim and Croat village. And she goes back to the village and begins filming. And as she's filming, the war begins to approach. And so it's filmed in real time. And to that extent, it's a very interesting film. And in the film, at the beginning of the film, before the war has approached the village, she interviews two women, a Muslim and a Croat woman, who had grown up together, gotten married together, had lived side by side together. And they swear in the beginning of the film that nothing would separate them. But as the shelling moves closer, as the fighting moves closer, the village becomes divided. And at one point in the film, after various tensions have emerged and the village has people in the village have become separated, the Muslim woman remarks, and I'm quoting, "Before we shared the good times and the bad. We never imagined it would be like this. Suddenly people have a different look about them. Their faces have changed. For me, it all happened in one day. It's indescribable." Now, Bringa's film and this extraordinary filming of the real-time approach of conflict presents us with a puzzle in the form of a loss. And the loss is of the fabric of village life, including things like these intercommunal friendships that had existed. And the puzzle is how something so seemingly fragile, something that can seemingly be polarized so easily, should nevertheless have persisted for so long. And these portrayals echoed so many descriptions of similar events that I had heard in my own fieldwork in Cyprus, particularly from Turkish Cypriots who were a minority in the island and so particularly sensitive to changes in landscape and relationships that were brought about by nationalist ideologies. So, for example, many older Turkish Cypriots would remark that in the 1950s, when Greek Cypriots began an anti-colonial rebellion against British colonial rule that was intended to unite the island with Greece, that although that was not aimed at them, still their relationships changed. They felt that very, very immediately. And so according to those stories, political changes that were taking place elsewhere were felt in the tenor and the texture of village life. And for some people, this seemed to signal the inevitability of conflict. In other words, there must always have been some kind of tensions there. But others give more nuanced versions of events, emphasizing that they were afraid, but at the same time often mentioning usually older people who tried to hold things together and whom they considered to be good neighbors. Now, of course, there's a large literature in political science and political theory on issues of multiculturalism, citizenship, difference, and cosmopolitanism. But none of that literature gets to the very anthropological question that puzzled me as an anthropologist. We tend to ask other sorts of questions sometimes. And that is, what values and norms and especially practices enabled and even encouraged people to live together? And why were these practices seemingly both so strong and so fragile? And moreover, in what cases have these practices enabled people to live together again after conflict? Now, looking at the anthropological literature on this issue of living with difference or what we call usually speak of as coexistence, I realized that so much of that literature was focused on things like shared religious sites, and that a surprisingly small amount had been written about the everyday practices of living together in villages and neighborhoods, or of working together in fields and markets and mines and places like this. And given the significance that so many people I knew gave to these forms of interaction, these practices of sharing spaces seemed to me to be ones that really needed much more investigation. And so to that end, I organized an international conference that we held in Cyprus several years ago on the way that people have shared spaces in the region. And we took as our frame this idea of post-Ottoman coexistence, or the practices of living together before, during, and after conflict within a region that's defined by certain shared historical experiences. And I'm just going to say a couple of words about this, the two terms of the title, these two terms, post-Ottoman and coexistence. Now, as I'm sure all of us know, the post-Ottoman space is one that is in many ways still defined by the Ottoman millet system that defined difference along religious lines and so became the basis for that peculiar binding of nationalism and religion that has been so prominent in the post-Ottoman period. And if we were to trace the dissolution of that space in some broad kind of chronological way, we could say that, of course, beginning in the 19th century, the spread of nationalisms throughout the Ottoman Empire led to changes in landscapes and populations. Places became nationalized. People began to move around, either by force or by fear. It's a space that's experienced the 20th century's first massive displacements, movements, exchanges of peoples. And as a result, throughout southeastern Europe and the Middle East, or at least the eastern Mediterranean, many places that used to have mixed populations are now sites of past violence, and they're marked by the absence of groups who once lived there. But that homogenization was never complete, and it always left remainders, minority remainders, Muslims in Greek Thrace, Orthodox and Armenians in Turkey, who also served as reminders of the violence that had destroyed these previous ways of living together and reduced these substantial populations to non-threatening numbers. So the post-Ottoman space, as we see it in this book, is defined both by the legacy of pluralism and also by the enduring puzzle of its violent dissolution. Now, we know that if many people in Southeast Europe and the Middle East today mourn this past pluralism, it's precisely because of that pluralism's destruction. So coexistence actually acquires a special relevance and meaning in this context as something that is no longer there or no longer possible. So this, for example, there has been in the literature kind of search for an Ottoman model of coexistence that, of course, is quite retrospective and looks back at what no longer is. Now, all of this also presents certain kinds of methodological problems when you're trying to examine these issues of a coexistence that has been affected by conflict. And one of them is just the problem that you have in any case in studying coexistence, which is that it's uneventful, right? I mean, if you want to, there's actually a kind of dearth of sources because these practices of everyday life that maintain peace in the village and in the neighborhood and so on are precisely the sorts of practices that sort of cause their own effacement because they don't produce events. It's conflict, actually, that appears much more in the records. So documenting coexistence, understanding it, is quite difficult in that sense. And then another problem is actually recognizing coexistence when you see it. So, for instance, is coexistence just non-interference? Is it a way of actively managing difference? Does coexistence require common goods or aims? Does it include or exclude violence? And now what we sort of come to in this book, if we can say that we come to some kind of agreement, I think, is that it is a form of sociality or a way of living together, and that is at the same time that defines at the same time both belonging and boundaries. So But what we are trying to look at is how people may cross those boundaries, the porosity or the or non-porosity of those boundaries. So authors in this book use coexistence to imply a recognition of boundaries, but also acknowledgement that those boundaries are negotiable in some sense, and that they allow us to, in some way, to get on with the process of living. And so while we all recognize the limitations of coexistence as a term, and I could talk about that more, but I don't think it will right now, we use it sort of as an umbrella way, concept for understanding these ways of living with acknowledged difference. In other words, you recognize that people are different, but you nevertheless find ways to live together. But we qualify this here as everyday coexistence, that form of coexistence that's specifically produced through proximity, through being close to each other, through being in the same space. In order to distinguish it from the legal, political, and discursive forms of coexistence that sort of imply the living together of ethnic groups within an empire or nation. In other words, it's one thing to talk in the abstract, as we often do in discussions of multiculturalism, for example, about how ethnic groups live together, and it's another thing to talk about the very concrete everyday practices of making do in a neighborhood or in a village. And so this allows the authors to explore how proximity is lived and negotiated through, and they do this through various terms, such as conviviality, cohabitation, or what one author calls co-presence. And some of these terms describe the active process of creating place through creating difference, while other concepts describe just the sharing of space in urban environments through, for example, inattention, refusing to pay attention to difference. So authors in the volume use case studies in Bosnia, Jerusalem, Istanbul, Nicosia, Alexandria, and other locations to give insight into the everyday practices of living together in contexts that have fraught conflict histories that include discrimination, displacement, and division. And they also stress the importance of boundaries that define forms of neighborliness and cooperation, as well as forms of what I call in the introduction everyday diplomacy. So they describe how coexistence is practiced and performed in daily life, as the subtitle suggests, in the shadow or aftermath of conflict. And as a result, they not only give us insight into past forms of coexistence, but also into, I think, the political potential of contiguity and civility for creating spaces that that are defined by robust forms of living together. So this is my, sort of summary as the editor of, let's say, the project as a whole. But I'm now going to turn things over to Glenn and then to David for to discuss whatever they're going to discuss, which I don't actually know.
Well, one of the great problems with not collaborating beforehand about what one's going to say is that possibly Rebecca said most of what I was going to say. However, can I pass this around? Not because it's a Bergon book, so it's all right. Okay. But I'd like you to look at the picture on the front cover of that. Uh-huh. And look at it closely, because it's an interesting picture. I've done work in both West Bank, Palestine, and Jerusalem, and in former Yugoslavia, particularly, unlike David, I was working in Macedonia. If there's some Greek nationalists in the room, I apologize for using the term without all its appendages. And one thing that particularly caught me at a certain moment was the shrine that is visible on the front of that book. A small shrine outside of Kitchevo. If people know Macedonia at all, they know that really from the earthquake in the 1960s, everybody really moved to Skopje. I mean, the countryside is fairly depopulated. There's some towns that still exist, largely on the skin of their teeth after Tito pulled the self-management processes out. And it's a impoverished area. But I walked into this shrine that's on the front cover there called Sveti Nikola in Makedonski Brod. Makedonski Brod, by the way, means Macedonian ship. And everybody said actually what it means is Macedonian Titanic because we've all been sunk. However, what was going on in that shrine was a very interesting phenomena that kicked off some of the issues that we then look further into in the book, which is how it could be that a small shrine claimed after the Titoist period by the Orthodox community in the town, probably in the Ottoman period, a Sufi teke, ended up being a place that throughout the course of a year could be very well shared. But not only shared in the sense that, as you can see from the picture, you both had iconography of Christianity and iconography of particularly Sufi Shia Islam on the walls, but also that it would go through certain transformations as the year went on, so that when Christian holy days came into play, the carpets which normally covered the floors, unusual itself in an Orthodox church, maybe an Armenian church, but not a Macedonian Orthodox church, would be taken up. The pictures of Ali and Zulkifar, which is quite eminent on the front picture there, taken down from the wall along with the other Islamic pictures, which normally were hung up right in the midst of all the Christian pictures of the saints, they would be taken down, hidden ironically behind the iconostasis, which should be the space of heaven. It doesn't seem the obvious place to get rid of heretical things. The whole place would be converted back into a purely Christian kind of place until 3 days later when people would come back in and reestablished all of the kind of arrangement of the place, putting the pictures back up on the wall, putting the carpets back down, replacing the white candles with green candles. Effectively, what was happening was two communities who were quite distinct in some ways, and not even living in the same place as each other, because Makedonski Brod had been a Muslim town, was now a Christian town, nonetheless were able to, and the term that we've used, choreograph their relations around the place. And one of the issues that comes up with this, and I think I'm addressing some of the things that Rebecca talked about tangentially in a sense, one of the things that came up in these relationships was a mutual dependency of these communities on each other. And the old woman who took care of the church, who was Christian, referred to them. She always called them them. But she said, they come, they bring more gifts. They bring more gifts than the Christians do. They're really nice. We get on with them. We make the place home-like for them. The Christians themselves would auction off the gifts that the Muslims left behind on certain days in order to fund the main Orthodox church in the town. The Muslims were getting at the same time whatever association they had with the previous sacrality of the place. Now, interestingly, in the midst of the place was what we can call a floating signifier. It was a tomb, which probably was the original tomb of the Muslim teke, the tomb of the holy man there. The Christians had one story describing what the tomb was. The Muslims had another story what the tomb was. They all would come into it. They all would revere it. They would all move around it. They would, in some ways, share many of the same kinds of gestures around it. So there's pictures I have. It's not evident. Well, actually, it is evident. That picture on the front cover has the two Sufi Muslims praying towards the iconostasis. In other words, praying towards the altar rather than praying towards the tomb itself. Christians and Muslims alike would circle around the place. It wasn't a syncretism, but it was a certain way that there was an assumption that there was power in a place, and that power was available to those who came and carried out certain kinds of practices in the place. Those practices were not practices that inviolated one's own confessional identity. You didn't, for instance, have Muslims crossing themselves. They might kiss icons, but they wouldn't cross themselves. There was a kind of mimicry with a difference that was going on. The reason I'm mentioning this is because this pushed me into looking at other issues, both in Palestine, where, sadly, a lot of the sharing is beginning to disintegrate, and other sites, including Cyprus, where certain kinds of techniques of sharing these holy places continued to exist. It pushed me further, and this is what Rebecca was talking about towards the end of her presentation, towards the question of how does locality work in allowing this kind of sharing? How is it that, in a sense, the concept that a holy place belonging to one confessional group might nonetheless have power that other groups could draw off of? Why would people share the assumption that somehow going and praying in Palestine at the shrine of the prophet Elijah, or in Makedonski Brod at what was supposedly the tomb of St. Nicholas, why would Muslims, for instance, take those kind of things seriously? And what comes up is an interesting issue about a kind of local set of practices which are penetrated by identities which extend into a wider world beyond that, the denominational world, the confessional world, the world of your priests and your muftis and your various religious leaders, but nonetheless enable people in those spaces to come and use each other's spaces. Now, one of the things, I'll come back to another thing in a moment, one of the things that Rebecca mentioned in the absolutely brilliant film by Tony Bringa, We Are All Neighbors, is the fact that what really kicked off the problem was the rumors that began to come in from the surrounding areas of Bosnia about the violence being carried out by Croatian militia or Bosnian militia against respective groups. In other words, something begins to take a situation and say, we actually can't, you said people look different. We can't look at people the same way because we know they connect with, they're part of, they extend to these other groups who have been carrying out incredible violences against our people. I've always been drawn by the interesting issue of the way the Nazis in Germany during the period of mobilization of anti-Semitism would give you a picture of somebody who looked exactly like your next-door neighbor, because they were probably your next-door neighbor, and then have projected behind them the picture of the very Orthodox, quite demonic-looking Jew with the skull cap, curls, etc., etc., so that this person may look like who you think it is, but actually it's somebody very different. Hidden behind that apparent neighborliness is a Muslim, is a Croat, is somebody who will kill you when they have a chance to do it. So something begins to happen to the concept of locality, which is brought in very often from an outside, which forces people to start thinking these spaces and these identities of people very differently. I think in some senses I'd like to leave it there, except to close by saying one of the reasons I think several of us have been involved in this issue around sharing is that we're up against a certain contemporary ethos which begins to talk about essentialization of identities, that these are Muslims, these are Christians, these are Turks, these are whatever, these are people who, regardless of what they look like when you see them on the street, are really these others who are really kind of irrevocably other, and therefore will, as one of the papers in the volume looks at, will take advantage of violence at a chance when they have a chance to drive other peoples out. One of the things we want to look at, and maybe it's Ottoman nostalgia, or maybe it's this wonderful fantasy from Benjamin about traces of a future messianic age, there's something about the way people share that gives us a certain kind of way of thinking again about the way we're being told that we can't share. So if people can share in these contexts, it's very important to look at what enables that sharing. Can we extend that? Can we find ways of working those kind of things out again? Can we get over the idea that the neighbor who is somehow different is necessarily an enemy, and instead see it as somebody we can share with, mix with, choreograph our relations with? Thank you. It's not a very good book, by the way.
It is a good book. Yes, well, I'm afraid that I will repeat many of the arguments you've already said.
You should
actually have invited somebody who is in disagreement with you, right? But we would have to fly somebody from Pittsburgh, I guess. Yeah. Right, so Rebecca asked me to say something about coexistence, so I will reiterate some of her arguments. So It is a great pleasure to take part in this book launch and to welcome Post-Ottoman Coexistence, edited by Rebecca Bryant. And there is a lot to say about the book, but not in 5 to 10 minutes, as I was instructed. And as someone who is actively working on fostering a dialogue and collaboration between historians and anthropologists, I would like to emphasize in my very brief comment the importance with which the book attends to the problem of understanding how coexistence intersects across the fields of history and anthropology. Coexistence is a problematic concept. If we start from a basic definition of coexistence as a set of practices that hold social relations between categorically different social actors together in a specific social configuration and a historical context, we can immediately see where the problem lies. The concept of coexistence is elastic enough to accommodate negative as well as favorable interpretations of such practices. Going back to the book, the concept of coexistence has become overused and dominant in many debates on the nature of pluralism, civility, and sociality across different confessional and ethnic groups in the Ottoman and post-Ottoman context. As Rebecca Bryant points out in the book, these debates are driven by an ongoing attempt to understand the forces that drive post-Ottoman communities apart by looking at those forces that in the Ottoman past held them together. We do not have time here to go into these debates in detail, but very simplistically, the great majority of these debates among anthropologists, historians, sociologists, and political scientists has oscillated between the enduring legacies of so-called Ottoman cosmopolitanism and pluralism on the one hand, this kind of nostalgic engagement that you describe in the introduction, and between enmity and antagonism deeply embedded in the Ottoman social fabric. These debates, however, represent a conceptual deadlock and incommensurability of their respective positions in our understanding what management of difference has meant in the Ottoman and what it means in post-Ottoman context. The recent sharing turn that Glenn has described earlier about these shared shrines epitomizes this deadlock well. The argument goes like this. The sharing of holy sites among various religious communities provides us with a window into the ways in which differences, here confessional, are accommodated. Hence, by simply focusing on these shared sites, we can also understand other forms of coexistence. For some authors, and I will not name them here, sharing is understood only as a temporal moment, whereas differences and Latin antagonisms are profound characteristic of the social fabric. So it's inevitable that at some point there will be some level of breakup of social order. The problem with these debates about shared sacred sites is their focus on the domains of what I would describe ritual and of the practices that lie outside of the everydayness. Shared sacred sites are then often conflated with shared profane spaces in general. Yet, shared sacred sites, as the literature from the post-Ottoman regions, as well as from South Asia, for example, illustrates, are usually the first targets of nationalistic ideologies fostering divisions and conflict, and hence not necessarily the best sites to study everyday forms of space sharing or shared profane spaces. However, shared spaces, as the book nicely illustrates in all of these chapters, are places where persons of different confessions and ethnic groups live and work side by side, as Rebecca described, with a number of forms and obligations to participate in each other's lives, from participation in weddings, funerals, to, I have my experience, haymaking, cleaning the pads, or communal spaces together. As such, these practices of participation constituted what I describe in my own work as a historically formed everyday ethics of coexistence. A number of anthropologists and historians, more recently, working in the region, have been increasingly looking over each other's shoulder to to explore the ways in which these forms and obligations to participate in each other's lives unfolded. This historically formed ethics of everyday coexistence represents the practices of everyday life that rarely find their way into the records, as Rebecca beautifully writes in the introduction, as opposed to the events that find their way to the archives and become a history. And here comes my general excitement about the book, as it is in many ways, I think, a landmark publication, for it brings this emerging exchange between historians and anthropologists in one of the most coherent and truly multidisciplinary collections to date to examine the grassroots workings of coexistence and making of shared profane spaces. So, to conclude, if this book has one lesson, and I believe it has many, it is that coexistence is a historically form of what Rebecca describes, and she didn't say it here, everyday diplomacy. You didn't develop it really.
Well, I mentioned it sort of at the end.
Yeah. I thought you will say more about it.
I thought you would say more.
Yeah. And I think this is one of the really powerful conceptual interventions offered in this book. And a few months ago, when there was this conference on post-Ottoman spaces, I mentioned that I thought that I coined the term everyday diplomacy, and I sent my work to Rebecca, and she said, "Oh, have you read my introduction? I also write about everyday diplomacy." And it's interesting that we work on the same region, and we came up with the very same concept, everyday diplomacy. So I think there is some interesting purchase to be further explored. So when we use the term coexistence, we need to recognize the existence of boundaries and difference, but also at the same time, and again I repeat only here, we also need to acknowledge that such boundaries can be negotiated. And by engaging with theories of everyday diplomacy, and there is quite an interesting body of literature on this topic, as this volume does, it enables us, I believe, to explore everyday interactions involving the proximity of persons who are understood to be different, and what are the mechanisms and practices to overcome these differences. Seen from the perspective of everyday diplomacy, then, as a practice to be able to enter these spaces of the other, like, for example, the one in Kitchevo you described, and address that other in a common language, so knowing, for example, how to act, how to behave in these spaces. Everyday forms of coexistence in the post-Ottoman spaces need to be understood and also studied then as the labor of peace. And that's another of your concepts that you should advocate here more. So everyday diplomacy is about the labor of peace. And this labor of peace, as the chapters illustrate, involves various local mechanisms. And that's where, again, ethnography can be quite useful to be put into a dialogue with history. Mm. So various local mechanisms of conflict resolution, maintaining cooperative relations between neighbors, forms of interdependence, forms of ethics of care, and ethic of concern. Also forms of greetings. That's something that I always get wrong when I'm in Bosnia, in these mixed neighborhoods. Because there people look the same. You know, I just can't see the difference. And also the very concept of neighborhood, komšiluk, that is widely shared across these post-Ottoman spaces. And some authors, for example, argue that komšiluk is an example par excellence of how these boundaries and differences and antagonism were maintained in the past. And in my own work, I looked at something completely different. I looked at how inheritance patterns unfold in these neighborhoods, and this was the main reason why, for example, people didn't follow up inter-ethnic, inter-religious marriages in close neighborhoods. Mm. And it was more about inheritance patterns than about faith and being categorically different, because they didn't want, or people don't want, to create unnecessary imbalance in terms of basically social equality in these neighborhoods. So it's also important to bring these questions, like land management, property rights, and so on, rather than looking for these categorical identities, essential identities that you mentioned at the end of your talk. So, and this brings me to my final point about the need to look over each other's shoulder in order to foster a dialogue between historians and anthropologists. As this volume illustrates, there is much to be gained by illuminating the existing ethnographic corpus through analyzing historical materials and vice versa, by letting anthropology and history to coexist, so to speak, in our engagements with the region. Post-Ottoman coexistence does exactly that and demonstrates how such an intellectual exchange can, in turn, energize our own analytical imagination and practice, whether it is focused on the post-Ottoman everyday coexistence or coexistence elsewhere.
Thanks very much. Good. Thank you. Thank you to both. Thanks very much. We'll see if people have questions and so on in just a moment. But before doing that, since some people came in a bit late, I want to repeat what I explained at the beginning about why there are not more books, which is that because it was a relatively small group, Berkon couldn't send someone to sell books. But in addition, so we have flyers, and you can order the books, hard copies of the book, at a 50% discount. But in addition to that, and now I can't get it. If we can get this up, then I'm going to give you the website address, because as I explained at the beginning, we were fortunate that Berkon has selected the book for open access publishing. So apart from one chapter, it's also possible to access the book as a PDF, or as several PDFs, actually. If you go to the Berkon website, you see that the chapters, apart from this one chapter, are downloadable as single PDFs. But if you go to this website that I'm going to put up in a moment, you can get the entire thing as a PDF. But for those people, as I said, who prefer to have a hard copy, and we're certainly encouraging that as well, there's the 50% discount, and Berkon will send you the book so that you can just order from them. Anyway, we'll get this in a minute. So let's, in the meantime, while we're waiting to see for this to come up, see if people have comments, questions. Yes, I see.
Well, thanks for the presentation, Valiant, and I find the topic quite fascinating, especially how you presented it as, you know, this kind of very, very deep question of, you know, if it is so easy to play a pattern of coexistence, you know, and come to conflict with your neighbors, with people that know each other, how come it survives for such a long time, and then you have this one event? And I thought, yes, this is really a very important question. Almost until I started thinking, well, there's so many examples of that I can recall in so many different contexts. So, you know, the London riots, how did everybody sort of behave like life is normal, and then we almost had a revolution, you know, overnight. You can think also the riots a few years before that in Paris. You can think all instances of revolution, the Brixton riots, you know, many, many more years ago, whatever. But also, like, you know, footballing events. You know, people live together, and then a football match appears, and they start, or in previous decades, they started actually being very violent. So I want to ask you whether either the particular post-Ottoman context or the cleavages which are religious, or the identity religious or national, are different to any other cleavages which then end up in ruptures and violent conflicts in society. So the things that sociologists perhaps will study more.
Right. I have a few answers for that, but I'm going to see if you guys want to take a shot.
Go for it.
All right. Okay. All right. Just to think a little bit about the issue of, you know, like a riot or a football match or something like this, and how that can produce these instantaneous cleavages. I mean, obviously violence that's between groups always produces those sorts of cleavages, right? When it's perceived as being between groups, and therefore there is a lot of sociological material on this.
Most definitely pre-exist of the violence. Yeah. So there's
Right. Yeah. Okay. So, but the there are two really interesting things about this particular context. At least two. I mean, I'll give you two. Right. But that I think make it very interesting to look at as a sort of socio-historical entity. Let's say this, what we're calling this post-Ottoman space. One is that we know from the historical record, okay, that there have been in the past lots of local mechanisms for maintaining peace, for let's say local conflict resolution mechanisms. Right, this we have from the historical record. We know that those things existed. What were those things? Let's say village councils. Or elders in villages, right? You know, and there were various ways in which this was formalized, actually, those kinds of conflict management or conflict resolution methods, right? And it was actually formalized up to the level of the state. So under the Ottoman Empire, this was actually a legal and political institution, these forms of conflict management. Not necessarily every form, right? Elders in a village managing, you know, when, let's say, someone steals a sheep, and, you know, or let's say, or even better, when, let's say, a Muslim boy elopes with a Christian girl, and that could cause a riot or a huge, you know, serious tensions in the village. How they manage that, right, is obviously not so formalized usually. But there were these mechanisms, and we know that, and it's recorded. And the fact that those mechanisms were linked from the village all the way up to the political center in a chain, in a legal and political chain, is quite interesting, right? And gives us a certain kind of context and perhaps. wholeness, let's say, that wouldn't have existed else, that doesn't apply in other contexts. So that particular, how could I put it? I call it elsewhere the sort of half-life of legal form, right, where you have these kinds of legal contexts for this. So that's one thing. The other, though, is that there actually is, we could say, a historical memory of that, in the sense that when you speak to very many people, they talk about the similarities that they have with X group, right? So there's actually a sort of vernacular sense that there are a lot of cultural and historical similarities within the region, and so what divides us, right? People will often ask. So in one sense, what we're probing is that vernacular puzzlement, mm-hmm, over this, right? In other words, people so often say, oh, we're really all alike, we eat the same food, we listen to the same music, we dance the same dances, and so on. It was those nationalists that drove us apart, or it was X that happened, right? So there are lots of different vernacular ways of explaining that, but the point is that people recognize that there's some kind of shared historical experience. And so we're asking what that means as well. So those are the two reasons for looking at it in this, the two, I'd say, main reasons that come to my mind right now for looking at it in this way.
Just down here.
Yeah.
I understand that the main subject matter of the book, mm-hmm, regarding fieldwork, mm-hmm, refers to the situation in the Balkans, mainly, if not wholly.
No.
Is the mythology followed? Does the mythology help you in understanding or get an idea about the situation in other areas, like Cyprus, when you refer to your own?
Actually, the book has two chapters on Cyprus, two on Turkey, one on Greece, one on Egypt.
Jerusalem,
and so on. So it's about, that's why we call it post-Ottoman coexistence. It's about the various spaces that have in the past been Ottoman. So it's we're trying to bring together that the entire context. We're trying to bring together case studies from these different places see what we can draw from that.
Thank you very much. We haven't seen the book yet.
Well, that's it. Yeah. So, we need to expand.
Not having read the book, I would like to invite two reflections on two comparative issues, the horizontal and the temporal. What is unique about post-Ottoman coexistence with respect to other post-colonial or post-empire coexistences in Latin America and in Asia and in other places? That's the geographical one. And the temporal, what is unique with post-Ottoman coexistence in comparison to the Ottoman times, if we have a rift, or if you found a rift?
I'm not even going to try that one.
Well, as I concluded, I mean...
You weren't listening to the conclusion.
Yeah, I mean, everyday diplomacy is quite an interesting concept to be actually expanded analytically, you know, elsewhere. And my own work and the way I arrived to this concept of everyday diplomacy is actually through collaboration with my colleague Magnus Marsden, who is working in Afghanistan, and with a community of traders who were one of these everyday diplomats, mediators, who were connecting between different geopolitical realms historically, imperial realms historically. So I think there is quite an interesting comparative purchase in the concept of everyday diplomacy. I don't think it's unique, but it offers quite a coherent field to explore certain questions post-Ottoman, so, and you can go elsewhere. And the other question, what's different about Ottoman and post-Ottoman? What created the post-Ottoman space? You know, nationalism, national ideologies, collapse of the empire. So obviously, that's what is different when people realize how other the others are.
I mean, this whole thing is throwing us at a major question about what do we mean when we talk about identity? What constructs identity? What kind of spaces these reified ideas come out of? And much of what I think all of us have been looking at is the question of locality, what locality does in setting up some sort of sense of a habitus that people are involved in, what is the implication of narratives that come in from outside, what is the implication of political leaderships. I mean, if you think about the Balkans in particular, you know, what was the impact of Woodrow Wilson stupidly extending the American model of every people should have a state to the Balkans, where suddenly every people had to say, well, what defines us as a people? And once we define ourselves as a people, what makes us a state? Similarly, in some of the work I've worked on in for instance, the Holy Sepulchre, the Brotherhood of the Holy Sepulchre, the sharing of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, you know, what starts to happen when certain kinds of identities are reified, institutionalized, imposed over other kinds of identities to the extent that people are uncomfortable doing something they've done before because it seems to clash with something that they're being told is important. I think David's point about you know, the historicity of so much of what we talk about identity is really a vital kind of question. And I think that's what in a sense, that's one of the major set of questions that the book calls for answers to or calls for further work on.
Because, you know, the other... Do you want to say something, Sean?
No, go ahead.
Yeah. So the other thing is something with, for example, Sarah Green, who is working also in the Balkans, describes as the importance of relative locations, where basically for a long time, where you are, that's what defines you, who you are.
Mm.
And the post-Ottoman era, in a way, is this kind of creation of these imagined communities that are actually telling you who you are.
Yeah.
So it's not the place, but it's something else. And obviously in the context of creating all these national borders, population exchange, and so on, it clashes with that. So that's one point. And the other point, going back to the first question and Rebecca's answer, is in a way this loss of mutual dependency and historical memory of this dependency. And I was thinking through during Rebecca's answer that, for example, in my work in Bosnia, there is, you know, I did some field work on one specific pilgrimage site in central Bosnia that was for about 150 years. The caretakers of the shrine, of the site, were actually, it was a Serbian family over, I don't know, seven generations. And the site was destroyed during the war by the tanks of Serbian army. But what was important was that the people who took care of this space for over 150 years, they left the place. There was basically no one to stop, to negotiate. There was no historical memory available, you know, so to speak. And the argument, the explanation of the local Serbian families I interviewed later on who returned to this place was, we would never do that. These people were from somewhere else. So there was this lack or destruction of historical memory of dependency that led basically to the easiness with which something like this 500 years old pilgrimage site was destroyed. In what?
In terms of culture towards coexistence, or memories towards coexistence.
It's a little bit of both. I mean,
it's hard to say. It's very hard to say. I mean, my quick answer to your questions would be that I believe what separates the post-Ottoman from the Ottoman is violence. It's a period of violence and conflict, and it not only physical violence or conflict-related violence, but the symbolic violence of basically rejecting it, basically all inheritors of the Ottoman Empire rejecting it as a history, right, including Turkey. So it becomes the suppressed history, and so in terms of what separates it from other kinds of post-colonialism, and this is a question I'm very interested in, actually, that it was part of what we were trying to do in the conference that I had held here a couple of months ago, which was called Interrogating the Post-Ottoman, and one of the questions I wanted to pose there was precisely this, you know, what makes this a different kind of post from other kinds of post-colonialisms? Why, when we talk about post-colonialism, do we not talk about the post-Ottoman? And I can't say we came up with very good answers to that question, but I would say that one of the things that separates it is that post-Ottoman nostalgia seems to be somewhat different from colonial nostalgia. I think that may be one, you know, productive field to explore. Because we know of colonial nostalgias, which are documented in many places, but post-Ottoman nostalgia seems to have other resonances and mean other things, and I think that may be one issue to look at. But I don't have a very good answer for it. It's something that interests me. Kevin,
thanks. It's a truly fascinating subject. A quick comment and then a question. I'm not quite sure how well this connects, but a few years ago with a few colleagues, I wrote a book about the Ottomans, the Lost Ottomans was the title, the Last Ottomans in Western Thrace, and the Muslims in the 30s and 40s, and part of the explanation there about the coexistence was essentially the eradication of a social class. That is, what was left was a rather poor tobacco industry focused population, and therefore it lacked leadership. leadership for rebellion, leadership for distinctiveness, etc. And this is where possibly there's something relevant from political science to come in. I found something. In political science, of course, if we talk about coexistence, then often we do refer to the relevance of leadership. And I think the notion of popular diplomacy is marvellous. However, a consociational democracy is one in which the social roots of conflict are intense, but where leadership manages to overcome that and to sustain some kind of coexistence. Classic work, the Netherlands, but we could choose other countries as well. And more recently, of course, if we were to think in terms of the peace process in Northern Ireland, we would say that a crucial factor was the shift of leadership. So I do wonder whether, when we're looking at coexistence in the post-Ottoman space, perhaps I would take from the Western Thrace experience the point about class and leadership, the absence of that. But more generally, in a more contemporary world, also the relevance of leadership to coexistence. And I just wonder whether the narratives in terms of how we deal on a popular level with difference, worthy in itself, is possibly missing another part of another dimension in terms of what's going on at the leadership or elite level.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not quite sure how well that connects, but here we go.
I'll start, and then you can. I mean, it seems to me that the example you gave, at least, represents a certain kind of teleological view of what should or would have happened. In other words, why was there no conflict, right? As though conflict would be what you would expect, and not having it
yes.
has to be explained,
yes.
right? I think that we're trying to avoid, first of all, that kind of teleological view.
Just add a footnote.
Mm.
Couldn't we say, though, by comparison with across cases,
mm-hmm.
the reason why the Dutch case is highlighted
mm-hmm.
is that it seems to have, it has had historically, a mix of cleavages which in many other cases has produced conflicts.
Mm-hmm.
Why hasn't it, therefore, in the Dutch case?
Mm-hmm.
Answer of Liepaert is the idea that it is leadership,
mm-hmm.
consociational leadership, overcoming conflict.
Mm-hmm.
But you're assuming the pre-existence of the cleavages, and I think that's what we're also inquiring about. That, you know, where do those initial cleavages that you say have been brought under governance by some other forces? I mean, one of our questions is we're looking at places where one might assume cleavages would have existed without leaderships to either mobilize discursively those cleavages or to put a cap on them. And we're saying that in certain circumstances, particularly in this Ottoman and possibly some of the situations of post-Ottoman, where those cleavages don't seem to come to the fore. So the question is not why don't the cleavages come to the fore, as you say teleologically one would assume, but what maybe brings them into existence. And in a funny inversion of what you're saying, it often seems to me that it's precisely leaderships that bring the cleavages
exactly.
into existence.
Yeah. I mean, in the places where we work, at least, I mean, and we all, perhaps the difference is that we all work on conflict areas, right? In a way, we're looking back at this from the perspective of cleavages that have emerged,
yes.
often because of leadership. In
yes.
fact, I think in all of our cases,
definitely.
We would say because of leadership. So we can understand the mechanisms that have driven these places, that have driven those cleavages deeper and have caused separation and so on. But we also know that that happened at particular moments, in particular circumstances, and had not been the case before. So without reading back some kind of history of conflict and saying, well, so we're trying both at the same time not to read back a history of conflict and to say, well, those cleavages were always there, but they had to be managed by leadership or something like this. But we're also at the same time not saying that there were no differences, right? Because there's also a tendency to say, oh, yeah, we were all basically the same, and then X came, X idea came, and made us aware that we were different. I mean, I think we know that, I think historians have documented quite well that in the Ottoman Empire, difference was something that people were aware of.
Yeah.
What that difference means, or meant to them, is something to be investigated still.
If you were to take the case of Yugoslavia, and I was there when the war was breaking out, or prior to the war breaking out, in some senses, there is always a history that discursively can be brought to the fore as something that we should be fighting over. Now, the interesting question is, why might that not happen at times? Why might that happen at times? Clearly, in the Yugoslav case under Tito, yes, we can retrospectively read back and say, oh, Tito was really just putting a clamp on all of this. But actually, what I was very aware of at that time was the mobilization by a new leadership in the wake of Tito's departure of precisely a set of reinvigorated histories of antagonisms and hostilities that weren't taught in schools previous to that. That's not to say people didn't know they were there, but somehow they become important at certain moments. So I don't think any of us are looking for this wonderful primal moment when we either had absolute peace or absolute hostility. What we're looking at is what plays the discourses at certain times. And I think that's a question where leadership has an awful lot to answer for, both positively and negatively.
And I think that after this we'll have some wine.
Thank you again. And there are many things that I will try to just stick to one or two. I was thinking whether you were talking about coexistence, maybe from a psychological, social psychological point of view. Well, couples, for example, came to me. People who fall in love, they say that, as you were saying about friendships, we were always we together. And then a few years later, they might hate each other, they might use their children from families who inherit from different brothers and sisters, and they tear each other apart. So this phenomenon of people who live together and who at certain points become very hostile towards one another is something maybe that is quite common in existence and maybe in different periods of time. Maybe what would make it specific in this historical context, why this kind of cleavages that you were saying become more important than others, could be religious, but also in civil wars in Greece, also brothers were killing each other, becoming, for example, communist, and the other would become fascist. So there was no religious or any other ethnic or possible difference if they come from the same family, the same village, and they have the same history. So there must be something very specific about this post-Ottoman context. And yes, I think that's
is that a good question?
Well, I'll just say, I think we all know and accept that ideology can have has had a very not simply important but overweening role to play in this context, and of course the civil war in Greece reflects that as that role of ideology as well, one of the things that we've tried to do here is to look beyond that in a way, to try to understand, as we were sort of trying to emphasize, the how, despite difference, people can coexist, how they manage together without conflict. And in that regard, I think the example of, let's say, a couple that falls in love and then doesn't agree and so on, I think maybe that's not the best comparison here, because what we're talking about are social groups, and also we're talking specifically about spaces, about sharing space. So we're asking, you know, how it is that people manage that despite the differences that they have. So I suppose it would be more like if for some reason you had to share a house with someone that you were divorced from or something, but you somehow you'd manage it. You have to manage it, right? So we're looking at the moments where conflict could emerge, but is managed. It doesn't emerge, right? And this is what I refer to in the introduction, and David made a reference to it as a labor of peace.
Mm.
In other words, how peace is emerges through everyday work, right? The everyday work of producing peace, in other words, we can't assume, and I think we shouldn't assume, that peace is an absence of conflict. In fact, conflict may be there, but it's a matter of managing that conflict, right? So that it doesn't actually create these sorts of cleavages that you were talking about. I mean, you know, your neighbor may play the music too loud at 4 a.m. and annoy you terribly, and somehow you have to deal with that without going and, I don't know, shooting them, right? So,
shooting's good. Shooting's good. If I can come back, though, to one of the things you said about ideology, I think we have to beware of being sociocentric in the sense of talking solely about groups, because really what finally comes to the issue, and it has to do with how one finds oneself in an ideology, how one finds oneself accepting a neighbor as an enemy, is the questions of identification. I don't like identity. Identification is very important. And to use the old Althusserian term, interpolation. Why is it that we recognize ourselves as being called upon at a certain moment when somebody says, you're a Croat, and that's a Muslim, etc., etc.? So I think we also have to keep that kind of individual sense of responses, but also, of course, then the collective sense of how the individual mediates those responses into a wider community around them. It's quite a complex field we're talking about. It's quite exciting, too.
I think on that note, we should have some wine.
I did have a little question, if I may, please.
Okay.
How do you compare the multiculturalism in London, at the moment in England, I should say, and in Ottoman Empire? I can say that the Ottomans invaded Europe. Now, single people, different nationalities, if I may say, invading London. In England, so what do you say about
that?
Vote Remain. I'm not sure if I should end it there. the only thing I'll say about that is that there was the Ottoman Empire was a system of managing difference, right? That was constructed as such, and so it was. The legal system was constructed, the political system was constructed around managing that difference, and it was not. In those days, in any case, the idea of individual rights, was not relevant anywhere in the world.
I have to say the three of us at this panel are all non-native British.
That's right.
We're invaders.
Yes, we're invaders.
What is going to happen
I think that's a topic for wine. So I'm going to